Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of April, 2017. Welcome to episode 23 of this podcast. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which makes this pretty much the books I read during April. To be precise, it's the books that are listed in the weekly blog posts at eyesandears.blogspot.com for the 5 Saturdays of April. Now, those posts I regularly repost on Facebook and Twitter. You can find those, but those are not spoilers for this podcast, and so those are just lists. And here is a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. Like I said, 5 Saturdays in April, so we have a lot of books to talk about here. And what we do on this show is categorize or classify the books that I read. And we start with the books specifically for podcasts, the homework books. For episode 97 of The Quarter Bin, I read 100 Bullets, number 11. And for episode 98, I read the Fables storyline War and Pieces from Fables 73, 74, and 75. And there is a once super secret project that I have coming down the road, which is in fact Quarter Bin episode 100. And for that epic, epic, epic episode, I read The Death-Defying Devil, number 3, New Warriors 19, Warp Special, number 1, Necro War, number 2, Booster Gold 8, New Gods 10 and 11, Jughead number 1, Dark Hawk 9, Superman 658 and 660, The Shroud number 3, and Ravage 2099 number 3. Now, for that episode 100, I recorded with somebody about a couple of issues of a Roy Thomas title from Hero Comics, and then later I found in the Quarter Bins a couple of the later issues, Captain Thunder and Blue Bolt, 5 and 10. No spoilers for episode 100, but this title was pretty solid despite coming from a teeny tiny itsy bitsy publisher. Good father and son dynamic, a globe-spanning storyline, pretty fun stuff. In comics I read for listening to podcasts, to listen along with episode 9 of the excellent Xenozoic Xenophiles podcast, hosted by the excellent Ruth and Darren Sutherland, I listened to pages 196 to 217 of the Xenozoic Trade, which was the story In the Dreamtime. Action Comics 711, Superman Man of Steel 46, and Superman 102. These are books that I've purchased over the time to follow along with Michael Bailey and Jeffrey on From Crisis to Crisis. These are from the Death of Clark Kent storyline, as well as a cool issue that was pretty much a backdoor pilot or a promo issue for the Power of Shazam series. These specific issues were covered on From Crisis to Crisis episode 209. On to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. These are all from DC Comics from the Rebirth era. Green Arrow, 20 and 21. We wrap up the Reservation Pipeline protest storyline in which Arsenal has to come to terms with his past. In 21, Ollie heads back to Seattle, which is still reeling from the death of the mayor a few issues back, Green Arrow being a leading suspect. But he didn't really do it. A bunch of evil people, the main bad guys, Four Horsemen, plan to destroy Seattle and in its place raise Star City. The highlight in these two issues, based on M's strong feelings about Roy's choices of headgear in terms of his costume, is this line from Ollie to Roy at the start of issue 20. I'm getting costume advice from the guy who wears his hat backwards. And of course, the ones we picked up were the Mike Grell variant covers, which continued to be excellent. Issue 21 in particular is very reminiscent of the old Green Arrow title. Great stuff. Green Lanterns 20 and 21. These two wrap up the Polarity storyline, in which Dr. Polaris breaks his brother out of hospital, assuming that his powers can do the healing work that the medical professions cannot. As you may expect, this goes poorly. And even Simon's miracle ring can't save the brother, which kind of upsets Dr. Polaris, which I'm sure will have no consequences whatsoever in the future. There's also another nice moment of Jess working through some of her anxiety issues. And at the end, Simon and Jess get called off of Earth by the Corps. I mean, they get called way off of Earth. DC Bombshells 24. This issue wraps up the North Africa campaign, the action in Zambezi. They fight off the results of the Thanagarian invasion from a millennium before. And we also get an interesting origin story for Vixen's magic amulet. And we learn more about the evil Nazi-supporting plans of the team of Baroness, Paula von Gunther, Catwoman, and Luther. Wonder Woman 19 and 20. The Truth storyline continues with Diana getting out of hospital with the help of Ferdinand the Bull. But Dr. Cyber wants to know the location of Themyscira, and they will do whatever it takes to Diana, or whoever else it takes, to get that information from her. In God Watch, Dr. Minerva Cheetah and Wonder Woman continue their fight, but mostly this is Veronica Kale calling Circe into our world to get her daughter back from Deimos and Phobos, which seems to work, except that the daughter doesn't reappear as planned, because the god behind the kidnapping is Ares, god of war himself. About a month ago, in terms of when this episode will come out, Greg Rucka has announced that he's leaving the title after issue 25. I'm going to stick with it and see how it continues from there. I don't recall who the new writer is right now, but it is someone with a background with DC superhero girls, which tend to be pretty awesome. And that could work for this, so I'm going to give it a shot. There is more from Rebirth discussed later in this episode when I get to trades and collections. But I did want to mention the fifth week crossover event and the one book that I read from it, Adam Strange, Future Quest. I bought this because of the presence of Adam Strange, and that story was fine, with the Zeta Beam part of Strange's character, him being thrown into the Hanna-Barbera world. Isn't that crazy a notion? And Race and Johnny and Haji help him restore his memories and get back to his era. But what caught me by surprise was the backup, an 8-pager featuring Top Cat and his interactions with Batman. Dan DiDio wrote it, and while I try to not say nice things about him, this was a pretty fun story. And I guess Top Cat is going to have his own series coming up? I don't know. It was an overpriced issue, and that always makes me nervous. But it was also oversized and pretty close to being worth it. And on to the general comic reading that I did. And straight from the discount bins at World's Greatest Comics, I read Walt Disney's Comics and Stories, Volume 36, Number 12. That works out to September 1976. But it reprinted a bunch of stuff from the mid-60s. Donald Duck had the lead slot in a story that starts with him trying to avoid his job working with Uncle Scrooge and ends with him and his nephews going all over the world fighting the Beagle Boys. The rest of the issue is made up of smaller stories featuring Daisy and Donald and then Mickey Mouse. Interesting stuff. Disney comics tend to hold up pretty well, even reading stories 60 years after they were originally published. Maybe especially reading stories 60 years after they were originally published. And Walt Disney's Comics and Stories 540, this is from 1989, with individual stories going back, in some cases, 40 years before that, We start off with a solid Donald Duck story by Carl Barks the Great from 1948. The rest of the issue is made up of stories mostly from the 50s and 60s, stuff like Chip and Dale, a Winnie the Pooh one-pager, and a ghost story starring Mickey. Whoever chooses the reprints for these usually put together a really nice and varied mix of stories. And sticking on the Disney bandwagon, Disney's Tailspin, number 2. Now, M watched this show a ton back in the early days, and I know my wife really liked it too, and certainly I remember bits of it. This particular comic was a continuation of the story from issue 1, but that was never a problem, as the first page and a half or so did the job of bringing me up to date. So in this one, Wildcat and Lily Ravenwood have been taken captive by the dread pirate Don Carnage. That's Carnage with a K. Can Baloo and Kit rescue them in time? Well, of course they do, and they're actually pretty clever in how they do it. Solid stuff. I left this one in the kids area of the waiting room at my dentist's office. And Ray Bradbury Comics number 2. I talked about issue 1, actually, last episode, which the great Kansan Grigor Rujo sent last year. I enjoyed it, and when I found this one at World's Greatest Comics for only a quarter, I had to pick it up. The theme of this one was horror, which is more general than the first episode's theme of dinosaurs, but Bradbury could write that creepy story here and there, and this is a pretty good selection. It starts with a Matt Wagner and Harvey Kurtzman adaptation of It Burns Me Up, with lettering by Tim Sale, interestingly enough. This was my favorite, a story narrated by a homicide victim taking place at the crime scene with his corpse still there and dead. Like issue 1, this one also included a reprint adaptation from the EC era, in this case Jack Davis adapting the story The Black Ferris about scary carnivals, which I know is redundant, they're all scary. I did not see these comics when they came out in 1993, but have really enjoyed reading these first two. Now, the whole series of Ray Bradbury comics only ran 5 issues, but I am keeping my eyes out for those other 3. Now, like I just said, the great Kansan Grigor Rujo sent a care package of comics at the end of last year that I've been making my way through ever since. And among those was Justice League Adventures, number 18. This was a pretty good story. It had a dark edge to it for an all-ages tale. What I liked is that it had the vibe of an old-time classic sci-fi story. Undersized aliens get inside Superman and are able to control him. Ray Palmer summons Batman, Martian Manhunter, Flash, Wonder Woman, and Hawkgirl to his lab, only to shrink them down and shoot them inside of Superman, Fantastic Voyage style. More on Fantastic Voyage later, to stop this mini alien invasion. It turns out that the aliens had sent out a ship a few decades before, only to have the entire crew killed by Earthlings after crash landing on the planet. Now, our superheroes know nothing about this, of course, but that's really weird, considering they're pretty much in charge of investigating alien spaceships and all of that. Well, it turns out that the ship was also miniature-sized. It was mistaken by a boy for a toy submarine, and the child unwillingly drowned all the aliens. So this new batch of aliens, their anger at Earth is pretty well-founded, actually. But they all chat, and they all understand each other at the end. But like I said, that was a surprisingly intense story. Greg's parcel of comics also included The New Adventures of Superboy, number 1. This was from 1980, and I had this comic back in the day. I collected this title for quite some time. It's possible that I had all 54 issues, but that was long enough ago that I don't quite remember the details. This one, issue 1, is a story written by Kerry Bates, and it's a little bit odd. It takes place on Superboy's 16th birthday, but other than the first page and a half, The whole rest of the story, I repeat, the whole rest of the story takes place 8 years before. That's not a bad story. Aliens offering Superboy immortality and his decision whether to pursue that, as well as offering a very nice portrait of the Kents as supportive parents. But 90% of the issue is a flashback? That's kind of weird. And Justice League Quarterly, number 16. This is a big ol' 80-pager from 1994. It tells the story of General Glory, who's being retrofitted to be DC's Captain America. The setup is that he's an older fella in hospital telling tales of General Glory's, well, glory days, to the paralyzed cop in the bed next to him. The genius of this book is that each of the stories is written and drawn in the style of comics from the era in which the story takes place. So there's a story that takes place in the late 50s, which is a total Jack Kirby homage. There's also a crime story drawn by Kurt Swan, which perfectly captures the era where he was the Superman artist. My favorite was the one that took place in the late 80s, late in General Glory's career, Return of a Dark Knight. It has so many things straight out of Frank Miller, and I found it fascinating that DC willingly published this, which pretty much mercilessly makes fun of all the trappings of one of the most famous books they've ever published. And that was less than like a decade before in terms of when this issue came out. And at the end of the framing story, the elderly General Glory gives away his secret powers to the disabled cop, allowing him to become the hero, allowing the hero to become a legacy character. Pretty interesting story, start to finish. And again, that artistic referential choice really took me by surprise. In Green Lantern, 108 and 179, these are from 1978 and 1984, respectively. 108 was from the GLGA era with the great Mike Grell on art. They were taking on an alien who'd become a conglomeration in terms of both powers and look of Wonder Woman, Batman, and Flash. And I'm going to be honest, this guy looked great. This being is revealed as a man whom Carol Ferris went on a date with. And of course, since this is drawn by Mike Grell, that character, that man, looked a lot like John Sable. In 1979, Hal was mostly in outer space somewhere dealing with Guardian stuff, while the Demolition Team was fighting someone called the Predator on the campus of Ferris Air, basically tearing it apart. The generous Canadian Rob Lance of the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, sent me some comics at the end of last year, including The Submariner 47. This is from all the way back in 1972, with one of the all-time great cover prices, 20 cents. Rob sent it to me, I'm sure, because it includes my favorite comic book character, President for Life, Victor I, of the great nation of Latveria. In this story, Namor is a bit amnesiac, not totally sure of who he is. Doom has been stalking him just a little bit, but not in a creepy way, on the theory that if he can come to Namor's rescue at some point, then Namor would owe him one. It's a genius plan, the plan of a genius, I mean, of a visionary. There's no doubt about that. Now, Namor did mess up this plan a bit, and they did have quite a fight towards the end of the issue. It was fun, early 70s Marvel stuff. Dark Shadows, number 23. This is a Gold Key book from 1973. I never watched the show Dark Shadows, but my sister got into it at some point when we were young. That may have been reruns. I don't know how long the show actually ran. Anyway, the story in this comic sounded like the premise of a Scooby-Doo adventure about the mysterious house on the edge of town that no cabbie even wants to take you to. But Barnaby and a few other folk investigate to find actual real vampires living there. High drama, high suspense. I'll be honest, pretty dumbed down art. But it was entertaining. Fantastic Voyage, number one. This is also a Gold Key book, this one from 1969. And from what I could tell, the series only ran two issues. This one had two 14-pagers. The first had a science fiction premise based on false TV transmissions that are panicking the country because fake news is nothing new. The CMDF goes inside a transmitter to find that the source of the interference is a strange electronic being manipulating the signals for his amusement. The second story is a jewel heist thwarted by our miniaturized heroes. Nothing dramatic, and the art is quite simple. But both of those stories were surprisingly fun. All right, time to play a promo here, and when we come back, we'll talk about trades, miniseries, long runs, and graphic novels.
Hello, I'm Mark Sweeney, and I record a group of comics fan podcast features under the name I'm the Gun. I have been asked so many times about such a ridiculous sounding name. Scratch that. Someone once asked me about such a ridiculous sounding name and where it came from. Well, I'll answer that right here. I'm the Gun was the catchphrase, the battle cry, the mantra of an obscure DC Comics war hero introduced back in the mid-1960s, Steve Savage the Balloon Buster. Steve Savage was the first subject of On the Gun when I began it as a blog back in 2014, and Savage is a great example of the kind of story, the kind of character I like to cover on the show. I'm the Gun lives in the third string, the fourth string. I love the C-listers and the D-listers, and in the age of the trade and the omnibus, hope to champion the underappreciated and the uncollected. And I do this on features like ITG's ABCs, in which I look at shorts found in anthology titles and in backup stories. Shanna Showcase, in which I index the significant solo appearances of Marvel Comics' greatest jungle queen, Shanna the She-Devil. Reboot Review, where I'm looking at least at the time of this recording, the criminally uncollected adventures of the post-Zero Hour Legion of Superheroes. And Where's the Trade, in which I ask the rhetorical, titular question and shine a light on some favorite run or title that has yet to be reprinted. Along the way, other odds and ends may find their way into the feed, so if this sounds at all interesting to you, I encourage you to check the show out on iTunes, on Google Play, or at its home on the blog, imthegun.blogspot.com. That's I'm the Gun, the comics podcast named after the most famous catchphrase or battle cry in comics. After Up, Up, and Away, and Avengers Assemble, and Shazam, Suffering Sappho, Got Long Live the Legion, of course there's Hawkeye, and Flame On, and It's Clobbering Time, Excelsior, and Brightest Day, and Blackest Night, Hulk Smash.
And we're back. Next up, the trades, and graphic novels, miniseries, long runs, that sort of thing. As I've mentioned before, more than once on this show, I am a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes, and since he's a character in the public domain, there are a lot of comic books featuring him. And when I find one cheap, or that I can borrow free on Hoopla, I pick them up, including the two-issue miniseries Domino Lady and Sherlock Holmes. I had never heard of Domino Lady, but have since learned that she was a pulp adventure character from the 30s, and that a series of audio adventures based on some of those 30 stories have been produced in the last few years. Those audio works are on Hoopla, but I haven't listened to them yet. But as far as this story goes, she served a bit of the Dr. Watson role, although a little bit hotter. But it gave Holmes someone to talk to explain his deductions to, that sort of thing. There's a murder mystery that involved ancient Egyptian artifacts, and that was pretty interesting. In terms of the Holmes stuff, he did get to disguise himself a few times, and that's always good. Now, this is not the greatest Sherlock Holmes story I've ever read by any stretch, but it is a Holmes story that treated Holmes pretty well, and that makes it pretty good. It was a quick read, but a good story, and I'm glad I read it. From Hoopla, I keep reading Digital Trades of Rebirth stuff, including the first Batman crossover of this era, The Night of the Monster Men. This went through two issues each of three titles, Batman 7 and 8, Nightwing 5 and 6, and Detective 941 and 942. While a massive summer storm pounds Gotham, Batman's team of Batwoman, Spoiler, Orphan, and Clayface, along with Nightwing and Gotham Girl, began helping their city by rescuing and protecting the citizens from the impending flooding. However, Dr. Hugo Strange has other plans, using the cover of the storm to release a handful of monsterized people into the city. This adds to the stress on our team, who have their own infighting, their own issues to deal with. And Dr. Strange, yes, they regularly refer to Hugo Strange as Dr. Strange, which is a very interesting editorial and legal choice. Well, Dr. Hugo Strange, Dr. Strange, has plotted this entire Monster Men thing as a way of confronting Batman with his own unique psychological issues. Good stuff. I like the team from Detective Comics. I've talked about them before. And I thought those issues were the strongest of the crossover, but it makes sense for these dramatic events in Gotham to be what draws the larger crew of Bat-related characters together, so the crossover aspect of the storyline made sense. There have been better crossovers before, of course, but as we all know, there have been even more worse crossovers before. Deathstroke, the Rebirth issue, and 1 through 5. I've never really been a fan of this character, so why did I borrow the trade on Hoopla when I saw that it was available? Because I'd heard consistently from a lot of people that this was one of the most consistently good books from the early days of Rebirth. So if I was ever going to give Slade Wilson and company a chance, this seemed to be a good time. This is the storyline The Professional, and it doesn't totally wrap up in issue 5. Christopher Priest is writing a story of a different length, which is interesting. The story jumps around a lot in time, laying in lots of backstory for Slade. That gives us his Rebirth backstory, as well as laying in past plot points for this particular storyline. The idea is that in Deathstroke's business, once you take a contract, you fulfill the contract, even if the target is someone you've known and have known for a long time. I think I can see why people are digging this, and there's certainly parts of it that I liked, but Deathstroke just isn't a character I have a lot of interest in. I dug Rose Wilson a lot, and the strange father-daughter relationship that was portrayed. I may pick up that second trade again when it hits Hoopla to see where this ends up going, but it's not, for me at least, at the top of the Rebirth list. Again, good stuff, but a lot of it is, again, just not for me. I mentioned the great Kanzen Gregorujo earlier in the episode, and included in that packet he sent were Strange Tales 3 and Strange Tales 2 and 3. These are from 2009 and 2010. Each of those years, Marvel published 3-issue Strange Tales minis under the Max imprint. And these issues featured comic writers and artists who normally create outside the superhero genre. It really reminded me conceptually of the digital-first Sensation Comics featuring Wonder Woman, short stories by a range of comics creators in a range of genres and styles. So these 3 issues featured works by Stan Sakai, Becky Cloonan, Nick Bertozzi, the Hermanos Hernandez, Jeffrey Brown, Terry Moore, Ty Templeton, and Harvey Pekar, and a bunch of people I hadn't heard of, but these were just a fun read. Stan Sakai writing about a samurai Hulk, Jaime Hernandez writing about the Space Phantom trying to crash a Marvel superheroine beach party, Terry Moore putting Thor and Loki in Norway in the year 1051. It was all good stuff. Most of it's silly. A fair amount of it's dumb. But it's also a fun, fun read. And because I enjoyed reading those 3 issues so much, when I saw the Strange Tales hardcover at M's Library, I definitely had to pick it up. So from that collection, I read Strange Tales 1 and 2. Again, these are just more of the same. James Kachaka, Paul Pope, Matt Kent, Peter Bagg, and many, many more contribute in these issues. There's a battle of the Inhumans versus Psycho Man, and an alternate story about the wedding between She-Hulk and John Jameson, and a crazy battle between Doctor Strange and Nightmare, and a Namor and MODOK short story. just to mention a few. That collection also had Startling Stories, The Megalomaniacal Spider-Man. This was a full-length issue by Peter Bagg. The what-if scenario posited here is that Peter discovers that the late Uncle Ben died as a result of his massive gambling debts. And he never really gets taught that whole with great power stuff. So instead of becoming a selfless hero, this Spider-Man becomes a selfish, self-absorbed, tyrannical CEO of Spider-Man Incorporated, a business empire that Peter builds based on promoting Spider-Man. And in this crazy world, he's married Gwen and hired J. Jonah Jameson as his lackey. Funny, weird, but a mostly enjoyable Elseworlds-style take. One day, I had some time to kill at a Half-Price Books location, and even though they have ridded themselves of quarter books, they do have the occasional 50-centers in the discount bins. And at that price point, I was able to find a decent, almost consecutive run of a book I hadn't really read before. Hawk and Dove, 10, 11, 13, and 14. These are from 1990, written by the husband and wife team of Barbara and Carl. I heard that Han Solo once read the entire body of their work in 12 parsecs. I know. Last time I mentioned Carl, my good friend Darren Sutherland mentioned that he had asked and learned that it was pronounced Kiesel. And that's all well and good, but there's no bad joke I could have made about the Kiesel run. Anyway, this is Hank Hall and Don Granger, and it's a pretty interesting series, I guess. There's a robust supporting cast, that was good. A range of relationship-based subplots, and a light sense of humor in the books. These were not earth-shaking for me, and I don't know Hawk and Dove very well, certainly not this iteration. But I enjoyed these well enough. I mean, 50 cents is pretty rich for my blood, but not a bad way to pass the time. And that's the bottom line, I suppose. From great listener Clinton Robinson of the Coffee and Comics blog and podcast, I recently received a few books, including Detective Comics 622 to 624. It's a three-issue arc from 1990 written by John Ostrander. A killer is on the loose cutting down victims with a machete and leaving his signature behind. He claims to be the Batman. At the same time, there is an in-story brand-new comic book featuring Batman, and the question is whether the serial killer is using the actual Batman as an inspiration or if he's modeling himself on this new comic book version. This is an interesting little arc. For most of the issues, we get about 15 pages of the current day, the quote-unquote real-life version of Batman working on the case. And then we also get 7 or 8 pages of these new comic book stories from inside the world of the DCU. Those are done in a different art style with a different artist. And all of this works together better than I think I'm explaining it. All in all, it's an interesting story. It obviously has some things to say about the effects that comics and other works of art can have on the real world. Also, all three of the covers for these issues were drawn by the classic Batman artist Dick Sprang, and are all images from the in-universe Batman comic books. They have a somewhat different character model, but it's really fun stuff. Quite an enjoyable handful of issues. My neighbor and real-life buddy Terry Colucci gave me some comics for Christmas last year, right out of his collection, mostly stuff from the 90s, including The Infinity Gauntlet 5 and 6. And this is Jim Starlin doing his Jim Starlin comic-y best. This was the end of the series, and it was definitely dramatic, with the fate of all reality at stake and all of that. I like how it ended, with Thanos exiled and powerless, but unbowed, just biding his time. Nebula had the power for a while, and she restored much of what Thanos destroyed, but ended up losing the gauntlet, which fell into the hands of Adam Warlock at the end. The only problem with this series that I could see, at least judging it based on these two issues, was that although Dr. Doom did appear in a few panels here and there, he only appeared in a few panels here and there. Look, now I met Jim Starlin once, and I would never have pegged him to be the kind of person who would harbor Latveria-ist sentiments. But there you go. Nothing else makes sense. But even despite that huge oversight, the lack of Doom, this wasn't a bad read. Having run into a few of these characters in the MCU, movie universe helped give me some context too, actually. Kill Shakespeare, 1 through 12. This is one that I heard about from a podcast interview with the creator, Connor McCreary. That was most likely We Talk Comics, but it may have been Deconstructing Comics. Anyway, the premise sounded pretty great. It's Fables meets AP English, which makes me wonder why I've never heard Tom Panarese talk about this. These 12 issues are the first full series, although there have been a few further stories and prequels set in this world. So for this one, you start by putting Shakespeare's greatest characters all in one place and time. So we have Hamlet, Othello, Puck, Falstaff, Juliet, Lady Macbeth, Richard III, etc. All interacting on different sides of the great battle. And what is that great battle? Well, it's the great quest to retrieve the mystical quill from the creator god himself, the mystical being who may, in fact, may not even exist. That god is known as William Shakespeare. I liked the structure of the series as it went on. You're brought slowly into the world of this story, as each of the first six issues or so basically introduces another one of the main characters. So we start with Hamlet, but as he's being introduced to these characters and the situation he is progressively finding himself in, so are we. He's our end to the story, and it's a good way to tell a story. I enjoyed it a lot, both the story and the art. There were a lot of pages with interesting panel structure, sort of designed as a stage would be, with lots of action going on at the same time in different parts of the set, quote-unquote. Maybe I should have finished up Fables before I started this, because there are obvious similarities, and it would have been easier to close one book in my mind before opening the other, but sometimes things like that happen. It also has similarities to the Inkheart novels and the Tuesday Next books by Jasper Ford. Basically anything where literary characters become real, or we learn something about the power of creativity, the magical role of the words of an author, that sort of thing. But overall, again, a very good read. And another of my hoopla finds, Betty and Veronica Comics Double Digest 246. I mentioned last month that I had read some pretty good Betty and Veronica stories. Because of the nature of those characters, just female friends in high school, there's a pretty wide range of the types of stories that they can get into. The newest story involves a lip-sync battle at Pops, which Veronica will spare no expense to win, and then it just featured a range of reprint stories, mostly starring Betty and or Veronica, with Sabrina and other female characters thrown in. Again, another reprint collection that does a really good job of picking the stories to include in the collection. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, as I discussed on Quarterbin 96, that issue of 100 Bullets is really intense, dramatic. The Adam Strange Future Quest team-up was fun. Kill Shakespeare was really good. Ravage 2099 was excellent. Sorry, I couldn't say that with a straight face. But the fact is, any month where I read Fables, it's quite possible that an issue of Fables will be my favorite read of the month. And I don't mean to make this an exercise in self-promotion, but more details are in Quarterbin 97 about Fables 75, which was the best comic I read this month. Now, next month, it's hard to say how long that episode will be. The semester ends in early May, so there may be more time for reading. But on the other hand, we're heading out on a European vacation towards the end of May into June, so for logistical purposes, the episode will only include books I read during the first 3 weeks, so it may end up being shorter than usual. Who knows? Well, you'll know if you listen to that episode, which should be out sometime in early June. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek, and of course the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. And thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.